hello and a very, very happy Father's Day to you from the Cory Doctorow podcast. For the fathers and the children listening to this, I hope you had a great day and honored your father or father figures in your life to the extent that you believe that they deserved it. And for the fathers, I hope that you got the kind of day that I got. I was woken up by my family with breakfast in bed. They made homemade sourdough pancakes with raisins, yum yum. And I got a very nice bottle of whiskey and a poem and a painted picture from my daughter and a framed photograph. And boy, I just couldn't ask for anything more. And my family have even promised to take out the bins today, which is usually my job. So I'm having a great Father's Day. If you want to catch up with me, then on Friday morning at 9 a.m. Pacific, midday in the East Coast, and 5 p.m. in the UK, 6 p.m. in Europe, I will be on a panel about the Communications Decency Act and intermediary liability with the Yale ISP project. They do not yet have a link for that. This is all a bit of a last-minute scramble, and when I have a link, I will push it out on my mailing lists and also on Pluralistic. And then on July the 10th, you can catch me in conversation with Hank Green, celebrating the launch of his new book, the sequel to An Absolutely Remarkable Thing. We will be doing a live cast in support of a Minneapolis bookstore as part of Hank's book tour. You can also catch him with his brother John Green that week and several other very special guests. I also have two books out the week of July the 10th. On July the 7th, they're reissuing Homeland and Little Brother with a new and very, very cool introduction by Edward Snowden. And on July the 14th, my very first picture book is coming out. It's called Posey the Monster Slayer. If you pre-order either of those from my local bookstore, from Dark Delicacies, you can get them signed and inscribed. We'll go and we'll pick them up and I'll sign them and write personalized inscriptions, and then they will ship and fulfill them. You can find links for that at the bottom of every edition of Pluralistic. That's my blog and newsletter, which you can find at pluralistic.net. Just look at the current edition and scroll down to the bottom for upcoming releases. On October the 14th, you can get Attack Surface. That's the third Little Brother book. And if you pre-order it and send your receipt to Macmillan, if you're in the US, Canada, or non-English speaking countries outside of those two countries, or if you are in the UK, you pre-order it and send your receipt to Head of Zeus. That also goes for people in South Africa, New Zealand, Australia, and other English-speaking countries, excluding Canada and the US. Then they will, on the day the book comes out, send you a new Marcus Yallo Little Brother story called Force Multiplier, which you'll get both as an audiobook and as an ebook. And then in addition, I have a pamphlet coming out called Working as Intended. The final details of the deal have not yet been announced, so I can't tell you when or where, but within a couple of weeks, I think we'll see it. It's a 37,000-word essay on how our discourse has been distorted by big tech, what surveillance actually does to that discourse, and what it doesn't do. Specifically, I'm very skeptical of the claims that the reason that we've become so polarized is because big tech has figured out how to use machine learning to, quote, radicalize us. I think that anyone who claims to have built a mind control ray definitely has a very high burden of proof, and I don't think big tech has reached that burden of proof. And I think that we can explain most of what's going on without having to make recourse to hypothetical mind control rays just by looking at the very dismal, plain, and completely mediocre forms of monopolism that big tech engages in, which is good news because while we don't know how to fight mind control rays, we do know how to fight monopolies. We just ban them from acquiring their competitors, ban them from buying nascent competitors, ban them from acquiring vertical monopolies, and break them up when they're too big. That's how you deal with monopolies. It may not work with mind control rays, but it definitely works with monopolies. The other thing to note in my personal life is that our contractor, after several months' delay, finished our pirate bar in our backyard. It is now built and standing, and we decorated it this weekend, and it looks amazing. It's got really 20 years worth of treasures that we've collected from all around the world, and it is so much fun. I mean, at this point, it's basically a Zoom background because we can't have friends over, or if we do, they have to sit at one end of the garden and we sit at the other. But at the same time, oh my goodness, it's so great. It really is the rec room bar I always dreamt of having. I grew up with grandparents who had great rec room bars, and whenever we went over to their house, I used to, you know, poke around under the shelves and marvel at the weird liqueur bottles and look at the cocktail parasols and the giant inflatable Canadian Club bottles and the peeing boy liquor dispensers and just revel in it doll, and now I have my own. You can find pictures of that either in my Twitter feed or, because that's a very high volume feed, if you go to my Flickr account. Flickr, my username there is Gruntzooki, Gruntzooki, or Doctoro, and you can find my pictures there. So that's all the personal stuff. Today, the reading is part 7 of Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town, my 2006 novel that features a man whose father is a washing machine and whose mother is a mountain. And if that, whoops, I got that backwards. It features, that's ridiculous. Father is a washing machine, mother's a mountain. No, his mother is a washing machine and his father is a mountain. God. Anyway, if that sounds confusing, you probably want to go back to the start, and there is a link in the show note to get the whole series. But in the meantime, here is part 7 of Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town. There were 12 boxes of books. The damp in the basement had softened the cartons to cottage cheese mush, and the back covers of the bottom layer of paperbacks were soft as felt. To Alan, these seemed unremarkable. All paper under the mountain looked like this after a week or two, even if Doug didn't get to it. But Marcy was heartbroken. "My books, my lovely books, they're ruined," she said as they piled them on the living room carpet. "They're fine," Alan said. "They'll dry out a little wobbly, but they'll be fine. We'll just spread the damp ones out on the rug and shelve the rest." And that's what they did, book after book. Old books, hardcover books, board-back kids' books, new paperbacks, dozens of green and orange-spined penguin paperbacks. He fondled them, smelled them. Some smelled of fish and chips, and some smelled of road dust, and some smelled of Marcy. And they had dog ears where she'd stopped and cracks in their spines where she'd bent them around. They fell open to the pages that had her favorite passages. He felt wobbly and drunk as he touched each one in turn. "Have you read all of these?" Alan asked as he shifted the John Mortimers down one shelf to make room for the Ed McBains. "Naw," she said, punching him in the shoulder. "What's the point of a bunch of books that you've already read?" She caught him in the schoolyard on Monday and dragged him by one ear out to the marshy part. She pinned him down and straddled his chest and tickled him with one hand so hard that he cried out and used the other hand to drum a finger across his lips so that his cries came out. Once he'd bucked her off, they kissed for a little while, and then she grabbed hold of one of his nipples and twisted. "All right," she said, "enough torture. When do I get to meet your family?" "You can't," he said, writhing on the pine needles, which worked their way up the back of his shirt and pricked him across his lower back, feeling like the bristles of a hairbrush. "Oh, I can and I will," she said. She twisted harder. He slapped her hand away. "My family's really weird," he said. "My parents don't really ever go out. They're not like other people. They don't talk. All of it true."
"They're mute?"
"No, but they don't talk."
"They don't talk much, or they don't talk at all?"
She pronounced it at all.
"Not at all."
"How did you and your brothers learn to talk then?"
"Neighbors. Still true. The golems lived in neighboring caves. And my father, a little."
"True." "So you have neighbors who visit you?" she asked, a triumphant gleam in her eye.
"Damn.
No, we visit them." Lying now, sweat on the shag of hair over his ears, which felt like they had coals pressed to them.
"When you were a baby?"
"No, my grandparents took care of me when I was a baby." Deeper.
"But they died."
Bottoming out now.
"I don't believe you," she said, and he saw the tears glisten in her eyes. "You're too embarrassed to introduce me to your family."
"That's not it," he thought fast. "My brother David, he's not well. He has a brain tumor. We think he'll probably die. That's why he doesn't come to school. And it makes him act funny. He hits people, says terrible things." Mixing truth with lies was a lot easier.
"He shouts and hurts people, and he's the reason I can't ever have friends over, not until he dies."
Her eyes narrowed.
"If that's a lie," she said, "it's a terrible one. My ma died of cancer, and it's not something anyone should make fun of. So it better not be a lie."
"It's not a lie," he said, mustering a tear. "My brother David, we don't know how long he'll live, but it won't be long. He acts like a monster, so it's hard to love him, but we all try." She rocked back on her haunches.
"It's true, then?" she asked softly.
He nodded miserably.
"Let's say no more about it then," she said. She took his hands and traced hieroglyphs on his palm with the ragged edges of her chewed-up fingernails. The recess bell rang, and they headed back to school. They were about to leave the marshland when something hard hit Alan in the back of the head. He spun around and saw a small, sharp rock skitter into the grass, saw Davy's face contorted with rage, lips pulled all the way back off his teeth, half hidden in the boughs of a tree, winding up to throw another rock. He flinched away, but the rock hit the paving hard enough to bounce. Marcy whirled around, but David was gone, high up in the leaves, invisible, malicious, biting. Who was that? I don't know, Alan lied, and groaned. Kurt and Alan examined every gap between every storefront on Augusta, no matter how narrow. Kurt kept silent as Alan fished his arm up to the shoulder along miniature alleys that were just wide enough to accommodate the rain gutters depending from their roofs. They found the alley that Frederick had been dragged down near the end of the block, between a mattress store and an egg wholesaler. It was narrow enough that they had to traverse it sideways, but there at the entrance were two smears of skin and blood, just above the ground, stretching off into the sulfurous, rotty egg depths of the alleyway. They slid along the alley's length, headed for the gloom of the back. Something skittered away from Alan's shoe and he bent down, but he couldn't see it. He ran his hands along the ground and along the walls, and they came back with a rime of dried blood, and a single strand of long, oily hair stuck to them. He wiped his palms off on the bricks. "I can't see," he said. "Here," Kurt said, handing him a miniature maglite whose handle was corrugated by hundreds of tooth marks. Alan saw that he was intense, watching. Alan twisted the light on. "Thanks," he said, and Kurt smiled at him, seemed a little taller. Alan looked again. There on the ground was a sharpened black tooth, pierced by a piece of pipe cleaner wire. He pocketed the tooth before Kurt saw it and delved further, approaching the alley's end, which was carpeted with a hummus of moldering cardboard, leaves, and road turds blown or washed there. He kicked it aside as best as he could, then crouched down to examine the sewer grating beneath. The greenish brass screws that had anchored it to the ground had sharp cuts in their old grooves, where they had been recently removed. He rattled the grating, which was about half a meter square, then slipped his multi-tool out of his belt holster. He flipped out the Phillips driver and went to work on the screws, unconsciously putting Kurt's flashlight in his mouth, his front teeth finding purchase in the dents that Kurt's own had left there. He realized with a brief shudder that Kurt probably used the shutter while nipple-deep in dumpsters, had an image of Kurt transferring it from his gloved hands to his mouth and back again as he dug through bags of kitchen and toilet waste, looking for discarded technology. But the metal was cool and clean against his teeth, and so he bit down and worked the four screws loose, worked his fingers into the mossy slots in the grate, lifted it out, and set it to one side. He shone the light down the hole and found another finger bone, the tip of a thumb, desiccated to the size of a large raisin, and he pocketed that too. There was a lot of blood here, a little puddle that was still wet in the crusted middle. Frederick's blood. He stepped over the grating and shone the light back down the hole, inviting Kurt to have a look. "That's where they went," he said, as Kurt bent down. "That hole?" "That hole," he said. "Is that blood?" "That's blood. It's not easy to fit someone my brother's size down a hole like that." He set the grate back, screwed it into place, passed the torch back to Kurt. "Let's get out of here," he said. On the street, Alan looked at his blood and moss-grimed palms. Kurt pushed back his floppy, frizzed-out, bleach-white mohawk and scratched vigorously at the downy brown fuzz growing in on the sides of his skull. "You think I'm a nut," Alan said. "It's okay, that's natural." Kurt smiled sheepishly. "If it's any consolation, I think that you're a harmless nut, okay? I like you." "You don't have to believe me, so long as you don't get in my way," Alan said. "But it's easier if you believe me." "Easier to do what?" "Oh, to get along," Alan said. Davy leapt down from a rock outcropping as Alan made his way home that night, landing on his back. Alan stumbled and dropped his school bag. He grabbed at the choking arm around his neck, then dropped to his knees as Davy bounced a fist-sized stone off his head right over his ear. He slammed himself back, pinning Davy between himself and the sharp stones on the walkway up to the cave entrance, then mashed backwards with his elbows, his head ringing like a gong from the stone's blow. His left elbow connected with Davy's solar plexus, and the arm around his throat went slack. He climbed to his knees and looked Davy in the face. Davy was blue and gasping, but Alan couldn't work up a lot of sympathy for him as he reached up to the side of his head and felt the goose egg welling there. His fingertips came back with a few strands of hair blood glued to them. He'd been in a few schoolyard scraps, and this was always the moment when a teacher intervened, one combatant pinned, the other atop him. What could you do after this? Was he going to take the rock from Davy's hand and smash him in the face with it, knocking out his teeth, breaking his nose, blacking his eyes? Could he get off Davy without getting back into the fight? He pinned Davy's shoulders under his knees and took him by the chin with one hand. You can't do this, Davy, he said, looking into his hazel eyes, which had gone green, as they did when he was angry. Do what? Spy on me. Try to hurt me. Try to hurt my friends. Tease me all the time. You can't do it, okay? I'll stab you in your sleep, Andy. I'll break your fingers with a brick. I'll poke your eyes out with a fork. He was fizzling like a baking soda volcano, saliva slicking his cheeks and nostrils and chin, his eyes rolling. Alan felt helplessness settle on him, weighing down his limbs. How could he let him go? What else could he do? Was he going to have to sit on Davy's shoulders until they were both old men? Please, Davy, I'm sorry about what I said. I just can't bring her home. You understand, he said. Pervert, she's a slut and you're a pervert. I'll tear her titties off. Don't, Danny, please stop it, okay? Darren bared his teeth and growled, jerking his head forward and snapping at Alan's crotch, heedless of the painful thuds his head made when it hit the ground after each lunge. Alan waited to see if he would tire himself out, but when it was clear that he would not tire, Alan waited for his head to thud to the ground, and then abruptly he popped him in the chin, leapt off him, and turned him on his belly, and wrenched him to his knees, twisting one arm behind his back and pulling his head back by the hair. He brought Davy to his feet under his control before he'd recovered from the punch. I'm telling Dad, he said in Davy's ear, and began to frog march him through the cave mouth and down into the lake in the middle of the mountain. He didn't even slow down when they reached the smooth shore of the lake, just pushed on, sloshing in up to his chest, Davy's head barely above the water. He won't stop, Alan said, to the winds, to the water, to the vaulted ceiling, to the scurrying retreat of the goblin. I think he'll kill me if he goes on. He's torturing me. You've seen it. Look at him. Davy was thrashing in the water, his face swollen and bloody, his eyes rattling like dried peas in a maraca. Alan's fingers, still buried in Davy's shiny blonde hair, kept brushing up against the swollen bruises there, getting bigger by the minute. I'll fucking kill you! Davy howled, screaming inchoate in the echo that came back from his call. Shh, Alan said in his ear. Shh, listen, Davy, please. Shh. Davy's roar did not abate. Alan thought he could hear the whispers and groans of their father in the wind, but he couldn't make it out. Please, shh, he said, gathering Davy in a hug that pinned his arms to his sides, putting his lips up against Davy's ear, holding him still. Shh, he said, and Davy stopped twitching against him, stopped his terrible roar, and they listened. At first, the sound was barely audible, a soughing through the tunnels, but gradually the echoes chased each other round the great cavern and across the still, dark surface of the lake, and then a voice, elusive as a face in the clouds. My sons, the voice said. Their father said, my sons, David, Alan, you must not fight like this. He, Davy began, the echoes of his outburst scattering their father's voice. Shh, Alan said again, Daniel, you must love your brother. He loves you. I love you. Trust him. He won't hurt you. I won't let you come to any harm. I love you, son. Alan felt Danny tremble in his arms, and he was trembling too, from the icy cold of the lake and from the voice and the words and the love that echoed from every surface. Adam, my son. Keep your brother safe.
each other. Don't be impatient or angry with him. Give him love.
I will, Alan said. And he relaxed his arms so that he was holding Danny in a hug and not opinion. Danny relaxed back into him. I love you, Dad, he said, and they trudged out of the water, out into the last warmth of the day's sun, to dry out on the slope of the mountainside, green grass under their bodies, and wispy clouds in the sky that they watched until the sun went out.
Well, I could not have asked for a better Father's Day reading than that. That was completely coincidental, but you know, there are no coincidences. There are totally coincidences, but that was a very fortuitous one. I hope you have a good week. I hope you are safe. And I hope that for all of our sakes, something changes out there in the world. Talk to you next week.
You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike US 3.0. Or as Woody Guthrie put it in another context, this song is copyrighted in the US under Seal of Copyright 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ourn, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Many thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's Ryneck Studio, Ryneck Studio at gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is a full-time self-employed audio engineer, producer, composer, and sound designer. In his free time, he makes beer, jewelry, odd musical instruments, and furniture. He likes to meditate, to read, and to cook. Talk to you next week.